Classicalization is a word that we introduced in the last paper. It's not, we will see a little bit the meaning along the seminar. And essentially, this is work I did with Gia Bali in these two preprints that appears here. And the work on classicalization is a work in collaboration with Gia and Jan Judice and Alex Kehagias. And appears recently, even today, Gia put into the bulletin or into the archive paper with one student of him in NYU doing some computations about this classicalization that I will try to explain a little bit. Okay, I prepared a seminar not very technical, just in order to discuss the ideas and to get also your reaction and to learn from that. Okay, then let me start with a little bit string theory. After all, whenever we want to talk about gravity, string theory is essentially the best candidate we have in order to define a quantum completion and ultraviolet completion of gravity. And then, okay, let me just try to say a few words about string theory that historically motivate this work together with Gia about this self-completeness of gravity and classicalization. That essentially is nothing that we can just prove at this point of the discussion, but these are some ideas that we want to suggest and to discuss with you. Now, what is string theory? Probably, this normally, after 30 years, or I don't know how many years working in string theory, in some seminars or in some workshops, somebody is asking this question, what is string theory? Looks a very deep question, but very surprising that this is such a deep question after so many years working in the theory, no? And probably the fair answer is that we don't know yet exactly what is string theory. We don't have a very condensed definition of what is string theory. It's a set of ideas, a perturbation, rules for doing perturbative quantum gravity, and many other things. But we don't have a simple answer for this general question. And we can just, if we are just quantum field theorists, we can just try to transform this question into something simpler and to say in what way we think string theory is a Wilsonian completion, UV completion of gravity. We are used in quantum field theory to think about theories that are not renormalizable and to look for UV completions of these theories, because whenever we have a theory that is not renormalizable, that has the theory has some coupling constant which are dimensionful, then we know for a long time that we have a cutoff of applicability in energies or in distances of this type of theories. Then we usually think in to complete this theory in the ultraviolet with some extra degrees of freedom, with some underlying dynamics, and to produce in this way a complete theory. Now, string theory pretends to be, in a certain sense, a good candidate for quantum gravity. And then the way I could put the question in this first transparency is in this language, is string theory, in a certain sense, a Wilsonian or a non-Wilsonian UV completion of gravity. Now, by Wilsonian definition of quantum field theory, that is what we learn from Wilson, and this is the way we work out quantum field theory. A quantum field theory is defined essentially as a UV conformal field theory fixed point. And the art of doing quantum field theory is essentially to deform this conformal field theory, that is the UV fixed point, adding relevant operators, and to do this kind of deformation systematically. Now, string theory, and we know for very general arguments that quantum gravity, or gravity, is difficult to imagine how can be completed in a Wilsonian sense. And there are many arguments, but the simplest argument that we will review in a moment, the simplest argument that everybody uses is related with the existence of black holes and entropy. We have that black holes enjoys certain properties, horizon, temperature, and in particular Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, and the formula of this entropy is not fitting with the formula of any entropy for any conformal field theory in the same number of dimensions. This is a good indication that if we want to understand quantum gravity, we need to understand the microscopic origin of the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, and looks like, superficially, that this goal cannot be achieved using a normal conformal field theory, and in that way you cannot achieve using a Wilsonian completion. Now, let's try to remember a little bit what is string theory. String theory was born as an attempt, originally, to define certain scattering amplitudes, enjoying a lot of symmetries, very particular symmetries, that is duality, but duality in the standard old-fashioned sense, STU duality. And simply this requirement that leads to Veneziano, to the famous Veneziano amplitude, simply imposing this condition that the amplitude should satisfy this duality, this leads to enormous amount of new results and new features, which is what we know essentially as string theory. And the consequences of attempting to find a consistent scattering amplitude enjoying this property of duality leads to some consequences that I just summarize here very briefly. Some of them are more basic than others, but essentially the important ones are the existence of a minimal physical length, which is L string, the string length. We are dealing with extended objects in order to get this duality for the scattering amplitude. We get a soft high energy behavior for the scattering amplitude that was realized immediately in the Rege limit of the Veneziano amplitude, much softer than we expect in quantum field theory. We get the famous open-close correspondence. In the moment we introduce quantum mechanics and the string can open and close, can open into two strings and close, you know, in the moment we have Feynman diagrams for string theory, we have that the spectrum of the open strings and the spectrum of the closed strings are intimately entangled, and we cannot reduce ourselves to open strings. We need automatically to have closed strings. And this is the origin of the famous relation between gauge theories and gravity. We have extra dimensions because the theory seems to be consistent only in 10 or 26 dimensions. We can have other possibilities using Liouville theory and so on and so forth, but the extra dimension enters very naturally into the game. Supersymmetry appears in order to kill the tachyon that naturally appears on the worksheet, and so on and so forth. Then it looks very surprising historically that simply the attempt to provide to scattering amplitudes this interesting extra symmetry of STU duality automatically has all these interesting consequences. Okay, then let's focus a little bit in order to try to see in what way string theory is completing gravity. Let's focus our attention on what probably is, at least the level of the discussion of the seminar, what I want to focus, for me, one of the key features of string theory. And one of the key aspects of string theory for me is the existence of an absolute bound on physical resolution of distances using string probes. This is a very interesting consequence of string theory. And as we will see in a moment, this is at the origin or at the root of many of the interesting aspects of string theory. Now, let me just think a little bit on this particular aspect, the existence of a bound on physical resolution of distances, using, of course, string probes. Now, this has been discussed at the beginning of the, people like to call string revolutions, so in the 80s and early 90s. This was discussed in many, many papers by many authors, the concept of the string length as a minimal length. What is the meaning of that? Essentially, this leads to what is normally known under the name of generalized uncertainty principles. These generalized uncertainty principles were first introduced. There are many authors involved in this kind of analysis, but there are two in particular that probably are more relevant for what we are discussing here. That are the papers of Amati, Cefaloni, and Veneziano by himself, and also the papers by David Gross and Mende, and so on and so forth. Now, what is the idea? The idea is that in string theory, since we have a minimal length, which is the string length, we need to have some modification of the uncertainty principle. And this modification of the uncertainty principle is a little bit visualized or exemplified here in this picture. This is the representation of the generalized uncertainty principle, as was suggested by Veneziano. And what is here you can see is that there is a small modification, which is this extra term here. Alpha prime is the length of the string squared, this extra term, to the standard Heisenberg uncertainty principle. This means a little bit what is the essence of the extended and fundamental nature of the string, is that whenever we want to prove small distances, the uncertainty principle is telling us that we need more and more energy. This will be the standard approach of the uncertainty principle of Heisenberg, this picture here, which is simply the quantum length, if you want, of the energy in this line. And then you can see that the way to reach smaller and smaller distances, to resolve smaller and smaller distances, to prove physically smaller and smaller distances, is simply going to very, very high energies. And this is the reason we are producing accelerators and all that. Now, this is the normal expression for the quantum wavelength of a particle. Now, if we believe that there is some length, which is the minimal length, the minimal physical length, independently if this is L string or whatever other length, if we believe that there is a theory that is quantum mechanically consistent and possessing a minimal resolution length, we need to modify this uncertainty principle, introducing some extra element, which is this type of element, where alpha prime is whatever is the string that is playing the role of the minimal resolution length here. Now, what happened is that whenever you have this type of uncertainty principle, or generalized uncertainty principle, I don't want to give too much importance to this. It's just simply simplifying a little bit what can be the quantum physics underlying a theory, consistent theory, with a minimal resolution length. It's a sort of modification of this type of uncertainty principle that you can just simply see that produce something of this type. Of course, going into higher and higher energies, you get smaller and smaller distances, but there is a moment in which you reach the scale LS, or whatever is the scale introduced here in this constant, and whenever you increase the energy, instead to probe smaller and smaller regions, you go up again and producing higher and higher length scales. Now, this is the result of summing what you will think, or what I will explain in a moment, what you can think as the typical quantum size, which is the quantum length, and this extra size that appears here depending on the constant alpha prime. Now, how we understand this thing? This is at the origin of string theory, and is one of the reasons there are many consequences of string theory related with this fact. In string theory, we understand this thing very well, at least intuitively we understand this thing very well, and the way to understand the physics underlying this picture that I cannot put full in the screen, but okay, you will remember, is simply that whenever we try to probe very, very small regions, we need energy in order to do that. But this energy is used not only in reaching these small regions, it's used in part, at least partially, in increasing the size of the probe. And this is the meaning of this generalized uncertainty principle. The meaning of this generalized uncertainty principle is that since we are using as a probe and a string, okay, whenever we want to probe these very, very small regions, which means very, very high energy, this energy is used in increasing, which is the second term in the uncertainty principle, in increasing the size of the probe. And increasing the size of the probe, you get a compromise and a minimal size that is the one that you can probe with this, that you can resolve with this particular probe. We know many consequences of this fact. In string theory, we understand that because the string is an extended object, which is a dynamical object. And what happens is that whenever we push the string to very, very high energies in order to use it as a probe of very small distances, the funny thing about this string is that it starts to extend in and using this energy to extend herself. And that produces this compromise and this minimal length. Now, what are the consequences of this? Okay, we can just reach the same conclusion that the L string is a minimal length using arguments of t-duality. I'm not going to enter into this discussion. But the existence of this physical minimal length implies many things. Among other things, for instance, the existence of a maximal temperature that everybody knows, that is the Hagedorn temperature, which is 1 over L string, which you understand essentially in the same way. Since the string is an extended object, whenever we pump energy into the string, part of this energy is not used, the energy is not used only in heating the string. It's used in distributes in producing new Rege oscillations or new Rege species. Then you distribute this energy into this set of species, and there is a point where you don't increase the temperature because the number of species that you are creating to distribute the energy that you are pumping is so big, is growing so much, that you never increase the temperature of the system. Then this gives the temperature, which is the Haber temperature. Of course, they have another consequences. This kind of generalized uncertainty principle is at the origin of the smooth behavior of high energy scattering amplitudes at very short distances. We can just do these Trans-Planckian scattering experiments that was the origin of the papers of Gross and Mende and also Amati, Cefaloni, Veneziano, in which we try to see, for instance, at a fixed angle and very large S in the Mandelstam notation,
we try to prove very small distances, scattering at very small distances. And we see that this scattering is smooth out in string theory, and the reason it's smoothing out is because this generalized uncertainty principle starts to work. Also, this leads to other consequences. For instance, a minimal size for the black hole. In string theory, the black hole, the minimal size of the black hole is L string, of course. And what I say, a natural mechanism to a smooth short length scattering amplitudes, which means, in a certain sense, fixed angle scattering with all the transfer momentum very large. And, of course, this is at the origin of some forms that are now very popular after the ADS-CFT correspondence of UV infrared correspondence. And this UV infrared correspondence, intuitively, is a little bit the picture of the generalized uncertainty principle that I presented in the first slide. You have here the UV region relative to the scale, which is 1 over LS. Here you will have the infrared region, which means energy is smaller than this 1 over LS energy. And then whenever you try to prove this UV, then you go into some length. This length, because if this is like that, you cannot do this transformation because you will get here and you will not. But if you have this picture of the generalized uncertainty principle, you can just, this is just heuristic, you can just move from this travel region to here. You move to the same point X, but this X now corresponds to some infrared. Then the same X, the same resolution length, correspond to this infrared physics and to this ultraviolet physics. Now, this sort of infrared UV correspondence is connected, intimately connected, with the existence of a minimal length and with the modification of the uncertainty principle in the form of the generalized uncertainty principles. Now, since we are thinking about UV completion, self-completeness, and all that, let me just, once I review these aspects of string theory, to think in two possible forms of UV completion of a theory. And then the two forms that I have in mind for the discussion here is the following. You have the UV completion Wilsonian, in which you look for a UV conformal field theory fixed point. For instance, QCD, asymptotically free theories are very good examples of that. And we can have, using string theory, as in back in our minds, some other form of non-Wilsonian completions. For instance, the type of completion that string theory pretends to provide to quantum gravity. And the essential statement in order to define this non-Wilsonian completion is that you need to build a consistent quantum theory, consistent with quantum mechanics, with a fundamental. Fundamental means something that you are not going to derive from some underlying dynamics. Fundamental minimal length. In other words, for the discussion here and for just simply introducing a little bit of notation, whenever I am talking about non-Wilsonian completions, I have in mind this kind of theories, a consistent quantum theory with a fundamental physical minimal length, L star. Now, just an historical remark, notice that the reason a little bit string theory was not a successful model of strong interactions is precisely for that. Because at the moment of the beginning of string theory, since string theory is essentially a quantum theory with a physical minimal length, then that this, in the case of application of a strong interaction, will be lambda QCD, this fundamental length is not something that the string theory will explain. It's something that the string theory uses as a fundamental scale. And makes all the scattering amplitudes or whatever such that satisfy the corresponding generalized uncertainty principle. Then what happened in QCD? What is the meaning of that in QCD? The meaning of that in QCD is that was the idea of true of the democracy of strong the or what I don't remember particle democracy or whatever. That means essentially that you are never going to try to go beyond the corresponding lambda QCD. Okay, you don't look for a UV completion in the Wilsonian sense to explain or to derive the corresponding lambda QCD. Now, in gravity, the situation changes. And in gravity, string theory looks like a reasonable theory because in gravity we are very used to have a minimal length, which is normally the Planck length, which is not necessarily identical to the string length, as I will discuss in a moment. But you see that the string theory arrives as a natural model of theories in which it's natural to think in the existence of a minimal resolution length. And gravity is one of these examples. Now, there are two dynamical approaches to non-Wilsonian UV completion in a certain sense. And one is, and this is the way I want to introduce a little bit, this is part of heuristics, okay, the way I want to introduce this classicalization notion, is that you can use fundamental standard objects, this is to follow the path of string theory, or you can try to use something that I will try to present a little bit, or to sell if you want a little bit, that will be just what let's call classicalization. Classicalization that I will explain a little bit more in the future, but simply here is a way of providing some dynamical mechanism to get this type of non-Wilsonian UV completions that, remember, we have defined as consistent quantum theories with a minimal length, is that to have a theory where energy sources inevitably create classical field configurations. Leave it like that, and we will come back to this point in 5 or 10 minutes, and we will have a lot of time for discussing this thing. But here, just in order to present a little bit the logic flow of the seminar, we are focusing on non-Wilsonian UV completion, and I am proposing or suggesting that we have two paths. One is the standard path of looking for fundamentally extended objects, or to have something which is very much related with gravity, and is that the phenomena that we have described for string theory, that is, whenever we try to prove very small distances, the energy is used in increasing the size of the proof, is something that appears in gravity very naturally. Because whenever we try to prove ultra-Planckian or trans-Planckian distances, we produce a black hole that has a size that is much bigger than the corresponding quantum length, which means we produce an object which has a size so big, so large, larger than the L Planck, and cannot be used to prove L Planck. This is the way, in a certain sense, gravity is telling us that L Planck is a border of what we can resolve with normal probes, with particles. Okay. Now, let me just go leave like that this discussion and to do a parenthesis on something that, in my opinion, is extremely deep, but I am not going to say anything probably new about that, which is that gravity, there is, here I was talking about a minimal length, and I was presenting this minimal length from a very down-to-earth point of view. I was telling you, oh, you must consider experiments in which you want to resolve small distances and so on and so forth. But I didn't say anything very deep like holography. In gravity, the length L Planck enjoys a peculiar property that is to characterize the bound not necessarily of resolution, that can be a consequence of that, but something that is probably a more basic bound, the bound on information storage. This is what we need, what we know in holography, is that the length scale of gravity, that is L Planck, and this is what makes gravity very, very special, sets the bound on information storage. Now, here I just put, but this, don't take seriously this picture, but there is a way in which you can relate the picture that we have for the generalized uncertainty principle from the point of view of holography, and will be the following thing. We say, okay, suppose that I am asking what is the maximal amount of information that I can store in a box of size L. If L is bigger than L, if L is L Planck, I can just store one bit of information. If L is much bigger than L Planck, I can store many bits of information. In particular, I can compute how many bits is the maximal amount of bits that I can store in a box of size L, and this will be L squared divided by L Planck squared. This is holography in the sense that this is the area of the surface of the box in which I am trying to store this information in units of the L Planck. Each cell of the boundary of size L Planck squared can store one bit of information. Now we have this picture. Then at some point we reach L Planck and we say, okay, if you insist in going trans-Planckian, what happened? You cannot store any information. What is this trans-Planckian thesis that cannot, I cannot have enough space to store information about what I am doing or what I am resolving or whatever? Now, what happened is normally that using the picture that we have for the generalized uncertainty principle in the previous transparency is to remember that whenever we want to enter into this ultra-Planckian or trans-Planckian region, the energy that we need by uncertainty principle is such that produces a gravitational radius that is much bigger than the Planck. If we now compute the corresponding information that we can store, not in this distance L smaller than L Planck that we know is nothing, but in the corresponding black hole that we create whenever we try to prove these small distances, we get again this picture, which is the dual to this one. Okay, this is a sort, if you want, of UV infrared, sorry, the UV infrared correspondence at the level U1 of information theory. If you are interested, we can discuss a little bit more on that later. Now, the holographic bound is based really on black hole physics. Okay, here you use something that I didn't use in the previous description of a string. In the description of a string, the only thing I used is that whenever you try to probe, you need energy, and this energy is used in increasing the size of the probe. The case of the holographic bound is using the black hole physics, and okay, we know very well the argument, the general argument, originally in Bekenstein, and we have a box of size L, and then the number of maximum number of bits of information that we can store in this box correspond to the following thing. We have the energy, by uncertainty principle, any bit of information inside here, we have an energy 1 over L. Here the H, I forget. N maximal, this will be the mass, and the mass multiplied by L Planck square is simply the gravitational radius. Better that the gravitational radius be smaller than the corresponding box, because if the gravitational radius is bigger, then this information that we are storing here is something that we cannot really get from outside. Then this is the bound of information that we can store in this particular box, which is this number. Then in gravity, as I say, oh my God. In gravity, and then this is a little bit the same relation that we have before. In gravity, I repeated myself a little bit, but we have a different argument that in the case of string theory, we are not invoking anything as a fundamental extended object in order to get a generalized uncertainty principle of this type that has been suggested by many other people. Well, here we are replacing the role of the string length that we were using before for the L Planck. And the meaning of this type of uncertainty principle is again the same. Whenever we want to probe very small distances, we need a very huge energy, but this energy, whenever we produce an Schwarzschild radius, this gravitational radius, until reaching the Planckian energy, is smaller than the corresponding quantum length, and you don't worry about. But at the moment, this Schwarzschild radius, that is whenever you pass the Planckian length, is bigger than the quantum length, then this increases the size and produces for you a bound on the possible resolution that you can have with these probes. This produces exactly the same picture that before. What we were doing before was summing these two guys. And here what you have, and this is also important for the word classicalization that we'll use later, we have a region that is this infrared region, or energies smaller than the Planckian mass, in which you see that the gravitational radius is much smaller than the corresponding quantum length. This is a quantum regime. Whenever we pass through this Planck, we enter into a regime where the gravitational radius is bigger than the corresponding quantum length, and then this is a classical regime. These objects are classical in the sense that they have a size that is bigger than the corresponding quantum length. Okay, these are ingredients. And then let me just first, in this seminar, to introduce a word that I don't like, but Gia insists in putting this funny name, that is classicalon. Then, according to us, what we call a classicalon, or what we will call during the seminar classicalon, first generically and after that in some particular examples, will be the following thing. We'll generically denote classicalon, a classical field configuration sourced by localization energy. In other words, we localize a particle or whatever, a source, in a region of size L, and this will produce an energy that I am calling localization energy of the order 1 over L. Then for L smaller than L Planck, which means I want to localize in transplanckian region, then I will produce a classical configuration. Remember the picture that I have before, the corresponding gravitational radius is bigger than the quantum length. And this classical configuration is sourced by this energy. It's classical because the corresponding size is bigger than the quantum length. And this type of configuration is what I will call a classical. In gravity, this is the example that I put, this classical one is a black hole. Okay? And this classicalon has very peculiar features, like horizon, temperature, entropy, and so on and so forth, that many people know. Let's forget, or let's try to disentangle, in the role of black holes in unitarizing high-energy scattering amplitudes, that is what I am going to discuss right now, the aspects that correspond to the fact that they are classical objects possessing an enormous amount of degrees of freedom, and other aspects of the black hole like to have an horizon, temperature, entropy, and so on and so forth. Now, that's the reason I am calling this thing classical black hole unitarization of Trans-Planckian scattering. I don't pretend to say that this is a rigorous theorem, but many people, I believe, thought, and this comes back to, I didn't put references, but here Tom Banks has been discussing this thing, Steve Giddings, many people that I would be alone. A set of references. I am not pretending, we are not pretending to have any originality with respect to this particular discussion that we have here. But let me just put it in a certain way that can be exported to other cases that will be the ones that I would like to discuss later. Now, there is a feeling in the community that the scattering amplitudes in quantum gravity that behave very badly in terms of unitarity bounds whenever we have energies which are Trans-Planckian, or whenever we have a center of mass energy S such that an impact parameter B, such that the impact parameter B is smaller than the corresponding S-Basil radius associated to this energy, what we expect is that in this particular short length kinematical regime, the scattering amplitudes of quantum gravity are softened by the effect of black holes, or are saturated by black hole as the only possible channel for this interaction. How this thing is working? The argument normally is the following. The argument contains two pieces. One is the amplitude of the, let's consider the elastic scattering amplitude, 2 to 2 amplitude. The amplitude for these initial two state particles to become a black hole in this kinematical regime. Now, here you can have two attitudes. If you think in the black hole as a generic classical configuration, you can say, okay, then the probability that these two particles create a black hole can be very much suppressed, exponentially suppressed by the corresponding action of this classical configuration of the black hole. They will produce some other things, but this would be to think in the black hole contributing to this scattering process, as we think, for instance, in monopoles, solitons, sphalerons, or instantons. But in the case of gravity, the situation is a little bit different, because since these two particles, whenever we localize the energy in a certain region, necessarily produce a black hole, necessarily produce a corresponding horizon, in this particular case, with S-Basil radius, now the probability of creating this black hole in this particular kinematical region is one. There is not the possibility that we can just organize these kinematical conditions and we cannot create the black hole, because the black hole is necessarily sourced by the energy that we are localizing in a certain region in these kinematical conditions and produce this black hole. Now this is very important for us. Here I am just simply saying words. But it's important for us to have in mind that in order to have this classical on physics or whatever it is, we need to have that in certain conditions, kinematical conditions, necessarily under these kinematical conditions, the corresponding classical configuration appears. In other words, we cannot have these two particles as a quantum state in these kinematical conditions that I put upstairs. Whenever we reach this kinematical condition, this two particle state is already a classical configuration that contains the black hole. Now, this black hole is a classical configuration. Imagine that we go to Trans-Planckian, very Trans-Planckian energies. Now, this can be a megaparsec size. It's a very huge object. Then, the probability that this object decays back into a two-particle state is essentially bound to be by classical arguments, semi-classical arguments. The probability will be suppressed by the number of degrees of freedom of this classical configuration. And then this probability will be exponentially suppressed. In the case of the black hole, we know that this is the corresponding suppression of the Boltzmann factor. Now, what is this? This produces for you a smooth out of an amplitude that perturbatively will go very bad, will go like S divided by mass Planck square. If we are thinking on this amplitude at Trans-Planckian energies, will grow enormously and will violate unitarity bounds. Then, if the black hole is necessarily the only channel for this scattering in this kinematical regime, then this amplitude is going to be very smooth out, which means that the elastic scattering amplitude will be very, very much reduced. The inclusive cross-section will be much bigger, because the probability of this black hole to emit arbitrary number of particles increases, like we know in normal black holes, and then the inclusive cross-section will go essentially like the gravitational radius to the power 2, like the geometric inclusive cross-section. Not at this point that the key ingredient of this mechanism, independently if we believe or not of this mechanism, but the key ingredient of this mechanism of unitarization is the inevitability in the appropriate kinematical regime of the classical long formation. The peculiar features of this classical long configuration will determine the decay back amplitude. This is true. And will produce details that will be important whenever we try to extend this thing to the standard model for tests of precision tests. But this decay amplitude will be generically suppressed by exponential minus n for n the number of constitutive degrees of freedom of the classical long, black hole in the case of gravity. Now, what I want to disentangle in this discussion, okay, and this is important for the rest, because if, is that the fact that the black hole has a horizon, that in the horizon you have a certain amount of degrees of freedom that take care of the entropy of the black hole, that you can think that the information that you are injecting whenever you reach the black hole is scrambled by the horizon in the degrees of freedom of the horizon with a sort of diffusion corresponding to the Hawking temperature of the black hole and so on and so forth. All these elements are not entering into this discussion. What we have entered into this discussion is the existence of this classical configuration inevitably whenever we have a source with the appropriate energy, and secondly, that this object has a size that is bigger than the Compton length and then decays like a classical object. And decays like a classical object means that the time of decay must be bigger than the radius of the size of the corresponding classical configuration. Okay, in summary, and this is part of this discussion, we should distinguish in this particular aspect of gravity two different issues. One is the unitarization of Trans-Planckian scattering by this procedure, and by self-completeness, what we mean is unitarization as a consequence of the inevitability of this classical one, that is a black hole, accidentally, in this particular case, contribution. Is, in other words, no extra UV degrees of freedom. That's the reason we mean self-completeness. Self-completeness for us means not something very deep. Means simply that we have procedures inside the theory, within the theory, to unitarize without adding extra degrees of freedom. And there is another problem, which is extremely important, but it's a different problem of the problem of unitarization, which is the understanding, the microscopic understanding and derivation, if you want, of the black hole entropy. Okay, here I have a marginal comment, but a marginal comment that can be relevant in a moment, I don't know, because I am running a little bit, that this kind of unitarization that we did, or what we present, or we just review in the case of gravity by black hole contribution, is completely different to the kind of unitarization that you are using, for instance, in the standard model. In the standard model, you need to unitarize the scattering amplitude of longitudinal polarization of longitudinal vector bosons. And usually what you do is to add the Higgs. That's the reason people are so interested in looking for the Higgs in LHC, in order to this contribution plus this perturbative contribution to go to order one, or then lambda, where lambda will be the Higgs coupling. I will enter into this discussion in a moment. Okay. Then I was having here a discussion of a string theory that, I will do very quickly because I want to spend some time in this classicalization for the standard model that is a little bit the most speculative and also the most promising aspect of the seminar. But let me just mention something about string theory that is a little bit in order to demystify or something that we are thinking about string theory. What is the relation, come back to the original part, what is the relation properly between string theory and gravity? Because many people think, it's a sort of a folk theorem, let's say, string theory, you need these degrees of freedom in order to complete quantum mechanically gravity and so on and so forth. But let's ask the question from the point of view that we are focusing in this seminar. In what sense the string theory proves ultra-Planckian region? Is string theory a way to prove regions smaller than the Planck length? Because if string theory is a way to prove regions smaller than the Planck length, string theory will be a very cool candidate for ultra-Planckian physics. And then everything I said before will be garbage because I say, I self-complete gravity without adding ultraviolet, extra ultraviolet degrees of freedom. Then in what sense string theory is going into Trans-Planckian region? We know that the string theory is the L-Planck is not a fundamental length, but L-Planck is derived from the string coupling constant and the string length. This is very beautiful because essentially what is contained here is that extension of the fundamental object, even if it's an open string, Plus quantum mechanics, which is the probability amplitude that the string splits and produces a vertex, produce automatically closed strings, and therefore gravity that should be measured in terms of L-Planck, which is the Newton constant. But okay, this relation is also very interesting, because the relation say, okay, let's think in string theory that we know only perturbatively, by the way, from a weak coupling or a strong coupling. If we are in weak coupling, L string is much bigger than L Planck, which is a little bit funny. It's very good from the point of view of thinking that L Planck is a very important length, but I was suggesting at the beginning of the seminar that L string is the minimal resolution length in string theory. Then, if I use a very small string coupling, this can be the size of the solar system. How is possible this thing? Okay, in various weak coupling, I have that the minimal length, L string, is much bigger than L Planck. How this thing can be consistent with holography? Because holography is measure information storage in terms of L Planck and not in terms of this L string. Okay, we will come back to this point in a moment. In a strong coupling, we are in a very good position in order to think about ultra-Planckian or trans-Planckian UV completion of gravity, because L string is much smaller than L Planck. Then string theory would be a very good candidate to explain or to produce ultra-Planckian physics. But there is a caveat here, because string theory is something that we have defined perturbatively, and here at the strong coupling, we need some non-perturbative definition of string theory in order to understand what this can mean, and in order to understand properly if we really have this trans-Planckian UV completion. Now, one thing that we were asking ourselves one year ago, is what is string theory from the point of view of gravity, simple-minded approach, gravitational simple-minded approach at weak coupling. In other words, we were thinking in the following question. Suppose I give you a theory in which you have a minimal length, Ls, that is much bigger than L Planck. Can you imagine a theory containing gravity in which this thing happens? This is one of the roles of a species that my friend Guy likes very much, to put 10 to the 30 species in order to solve almost everything. But okay, this is a different story. And the role of a species is the following. Okay, let me just make a comment, holographic comment, about this relation between L string and L Planck. If you have in this weak coupling regime, and you say, okay, let me just check what is this quantity. A box of size L string in 10 dimensions in units of L Planck. This will be the size of the boundary of this box. And this holographically means the maximal amount of information that I can store in a box of the string length. But this turns out to be 1 over G string squared. Then we were asking ourselves, oh, probably there is a possibility to understand the string coupling information theory point of view like counting a sort of number of species or number of or amount of information that we can attach with zero amount of energy, without adding energy, to the string. But what is this kind of information that we can attach to a string without exciting the string, without producing Rege excitations? It's Champaton factors. We can, of course, introduce at the boundary of the string labels A, B, C, D, which are the Champaton factors, and this is what define what you, if you want to call, open string species. This, for instance, will be when you go to the limit of field theory limit, will be the species corresponding to a gauge theory, the gauge group, and so on and so forth. Then what we were thinking is that 1 over G string squared, if we believe in holographic principle, sets the bound of information that you can attach to the strings, in other words, on the number of Champaton factors or open string species. Moreover, in this weak coupling regime, we know that the L string sets, because we were discussing this thing at the beginning, the minimal size of a black hole. But this sounds very familiar to us. We have a theory in which we have 1 over G string squared species. We have a length which is much bigger than L Planck that says the minimal size of a black hole. This is the typical situation, without doing very much sophisticated physics, that you will get if you just consider gravity and add weakly coupled species. If you consider gravity in the presence of M particle species, you can very easily check that the black hole size must be bigger than what is called the species scale, which is defined in this particular way. The reason for that is very simple. You have very many particle species. The black hole is evaporating very quickly because have many more channels to evaporate. Then at some point, what happens is that the black hole, if it's not of a particular size, if it's of a size smaller than this species scale, is decaying, is evaporating faster than allowed by semi-classical arguments, which means that the corresponding time of evaporation will be smaller than the corresponding radius. Now, this is very funny because, in particular, black holes of smaller size, and although L much bigger than L plan, notice that if I put M as large as I wish, this will be much bigger than L plan for large enough N, are not semi-classical in the sense that they will decay too fast, which means the time of evaporation will be smaller than R. Then what we have, this I believe I am saying a little bit too fast, but I want to move into other stuff. We can see that in the background of ND9 brains, which is the way to reproduce N species, consistency with gravity and string theory implies that the L string must be this species scale, and this identification that comes from a very semi-classical argument in gravity using black holes leads to 1 over G string equal to the number of species, that is what holography was telling us. And then there is a very much consistency between the argument of the size of the black hole and semi-classicality of black holes and the holographic bound, which gives you the interpretation of this string coupling constant bounded by the number of species. Notice that this is the relation you get in 1 over N expansion in TOF coupling. If you consider the number of species, the number of Chan-Patton factors, this will be SUN, SUN small, and then 1 over N will be the relation for the coupling in the Larsen limit. Okay, then we just claim it, but this will not be the main important topic here, that gravity in the weakly coupled string theory is essentially gravity with 1 over G string squared species. Now, let me just make a comment. What about strong string coupling? In the case of strong string coupling, let me just simply say that, of course, we enter into the non-perturbative regime. I will need a little bit more time for discussing this, but anyway. In the non-perturbative regime, we need to move into either a theory that is S-dual, like I to be, or we need to enter into a theory which is N-theory. In the case of N-theory, we enter into extra dimension, which is 11-dimensional gravity. And in this 11-dimensional gravity, the length that now plays the role of the minimal length, and there is no possibility to prove lengths smaller than that, is L-Planck 11. In other words, even in the case of strong coupling or in the case of weak coupling, string theory is never providing candidates for degrees of freedom that will be transplanckian. If you want, I can discuss this thing later, but okay, let me just move a little bit. Now, summarizing until now, the role of the black holes in unitarizing transplanckian gravity relies on their inevitability and classical nature, involving large number of degrees of freedom. A priori, any inevitable classical configuration could play the same role. And a different issue is the microscopic derivation of black hole entropy. Now, let me just forget about this discussion. If you want, we can come back if we have time or later. Once we observe that black hole unitarization doesn't rely on existence of horizon, our next task, and this is what I want to spend at least the last 5 minutes, is can we export this form of unitarization to non-gravitational theories, in particular to a Higgsless standard model? Then let me just spend 1 second to focus the question. First, we use gravity and the unitarization of scattering amplitudes that at 3-level grow with energy in a way that violate unitarity using black hole contribution. We identify the properties of the black holes in this unitarization process as 2. Inevitability of the creation of this classical configuration and the classical nature of this configuration, which means that the decay back is exponentially suppressed. Now, once we have that, which is not requiring a horizon for the black hole and so on and so forth, we say, okay, can we have any theory in the world satisfying suffering of a problem of 3-level unitarity and such that contains inside the theory, without adding anything extra to the theory, a mechanism such that whenever we try to localize energy in a scattering beyond the point allowed by the unitarity of this theory, we create necessarily a classical configuration, which means with a size that is bigger than the corresponding contour length, such that will unitarize this amplitude? This is the question that we want to ask, and this is what we call unitarization by classicalization. Then what do we need? Okay, what are the rules of the game in the case that the games makes any sense? The rules of the game would be the following. Consider a theory with 3-level unitarity problems, for instance. You have a theory where you have some scale, which is what we can call the unitarity scale, and the 3-level goes in that way. Of course, this is very bad because you have unitarity problems when S grows. Then what we need is that any field quanta of this theory, any field quanta localized in a region L, inevitably creates a classical field configuration of the corresponding fields in our theory of size R star L, which is bigger than 1 over M star, which is what characterizes the unitarity scale, for L smaller than 1 over M star. What this means? This means that whenever we want to enter into a kinematical region that will violate unitarity bound, which means L smaller than 1 over M star, automatically we create an object, which is a classical object, with size that is much bigger than 1 over M star, which means a classical object with size much bigger than any quantum length involved in the problem, and then we need to saturate the corresponding scattering amplitude as the contribution, because it's inevitable, we need to prove that, the inevitability of the contribution of this classical configuration. Then the size R star L is defined as the scale at which observable effects of the field configuration created by this source, by the energy source, becomes order one in M star units. Now we have two natural options. And describing this, I will think. We have an option which is a little bit very cheap, is you say, oh, let me add an extra classicalizer field coupled to everything, to the energy momentum tensor of the theory. But this is equivalent to add a sort of fake gravity that is playing for you a way to unitarize in the way gravity unitarizes. Then forget about this possibility. But then we have another possibility that is more interesting, that is self-classicalization. Now, in self-classicalization, what we will look for is theories where one fundamental field of the theory works as a classicalizer. In this case, we can unitarize by classicalization those perturbatively non-unitarity amplitudes governed by the self-interactions of this field. Then self-classicalization means that we have a field in the theory that is coupled to the energy momentum tensor, and therefore immediately is activated in any scattering amplitude when we have localized energy in a certain regions, and produce configuration which are classical and of size which are bigger than the corresponding quantum left entering or governing this scattering amplitude. Now, this will be worse, and then let me just finish with one example, then, which is the only example that I believe can play this thing, and this probably, if this makes, all this thing makes sense, is a big thing. We will suggest that the spontaneous symmetry breaking sector of the standard model, in general, the spontaneous symmetry breaking sector of almost any theory, but let's concentrate on a realistic theory of the standard model, can enjoy classicalization with the Nambu-Goldstone field as the natural classicalizer. In particular, the only example beyond gravity in which this classicalization mechanism can work is the type of theories that we associated with as effective theories describing a spontaneous symmetry breaking. In other words, Nambu-Goldstone or longitudinal polarizations. Let me just describe this thing in a moment. I will use, can I use 4 minutes or something like that? Then let me just remind you unitarity problems in the standard model. This is interesting because it looks that the problem of the unitarization of the standard model is going to be precisely playing the role of a virtue for us if we believe in this classicalization. Let me explain to you this thing in a moment. The dangerous amplitudes in the standard model, as everybody knows, are those with longitudinal vector bosons as asymptotic states. The reason for that is something that we know very well. Longitudinal polarizations goes like P mu divided by MW. In this particular case, this is the scale. And therefore, whenever we have an amplitude in which two of the external lines are longitudinal polarizations, we get that this increases with energy, and we get that the amplitude is dominated by a factor S divided by mass to the power 2. Now, the spontaneous symmetry breaking, this is a problem that people realize immediately whenever you try to do a theory which is Higgsless. In other words, you try to do a theory which has vector bosons that are massive, but you don't introduce a Higgs field, a Higgs particle, in your theory. Then immediately people realize at the beginning of the standard model that, okay, this theory is non-renormalizable in a certain sense that we can discuss right now. But the first point from the point of view of unitarity is that you have that the amplitudes grows like a power of the energy. If the amplitudes grows like a power of the energy and you try to unitarize the problem by optical theorem, you will need in the dispersion relation to make a lot of subtractions. More and more subtractions at each higher level in perturbation theory. This is non-renormalizability. You need contact terms and infinite number of contact terms if at three level you have something that is growing beyond unitarity, by the unitarity constraint. Now, in the spontaneous symmetry breaking approach to the massive vector bosons, what it leads is to the equivalence theorem that we know very well, and is that in the high energy limit, we can describe the scattering of longitudinal vector bosons using essentially just the Nambu-Goldstone effective theory for the unphysical Goldstone bosons. In the U-gauge, you don't see that, but in the R-gauge, you see these guys, which are the unphysical Goldstone bosons. You have a Lagrangian, that is the effective theory for these Goldstone bosons. And this effective theory for these Goldstone bosons can be simply defined, this is the statement in Wernicke-Salar model. This would be just the effective theory associated with the Goldstone bosons. Now, the equivalent theorem is telling you, okay, the amplitude for longitudinal polarization is equal to the amplitude for the corresponding Goldstone bosons. Very good. And this amplitude is given by the corresponding effective Lagrangian governing the symmetry breaking. Essentially, this is the sigma model G divided by H, but you can introduce or not introduce the corresponding Higgs. Let's see how this enters into the unitarization game. Now, when you do this computation, you simply use the G divided by H standard sigma model, you get that this amplitude grows like you expect, like S divided by M to the power 2. Now, this leads to a problem of unitarity. Now, how do you solve this problem of unitarization? Okay, you say, oh, my spontaneous symmetry breaking contains not only the fake unphysical Goldstone bosons, also the Higgs. And the Higgs enters into the game, and there is a coupling for phi phi to the Higgs, and phi phi to Higgs squared with a corresponding coupling here. And whenever I introduce this extra coupling, I unitarize the corresponding vector, the corresponding polarization, the corresponding scattering amplitude for longitudinal polarizations. Now, in a Higgsless model that people have been trying many, many times, what you do is the following thing. What you do is, okay, take the spontaneous symmetry breaking sector and try to use to get a theory which is the one that you get whenever you send the mass of the Higgs to infinity by sending the coupling of the Higgs to infinity but keeping the vacuum expectation value finite. In this particular way, you get the masses of the vector bosons, but the Higgs is out of your game. Then what you get in this particular theory is an effective Lagrangian only for the Boston boson degrees of freedom. And this effective Lagrangian is a typical Lagrangian that contains coupling constants that are dimensionful and so on and so forth. Now, what is the message that we want to have here? What we want to have here, what I pretend to say is, okay, this type of Lagrangian that you will get for the Goldstone bosons in the Higgsless limit, whenever you send lambda to infinity keeping the vacuum expectation value finite, is a good Lagrangian to check classicalization. And the reason for that is the following. The reason is that the Nambu-Goldstone bosons are the only guys that have a coupling which is a derivative coupling. This is coming from the fact that the Nambu-Goldstone, the equivalence theorem, the Nambu-Goldstone boson must describe a scattering of guys with longitudinal polarizations that goes like P divided by N, like P, like energy. Now, this Nambu-Goldstone boson theory contains at least one of the ingredients that we want. We have sources, energy is a source, a natural source of the field. Now, what we need to check is if the Lagrangian is nice enough in order to produce whenever we have concentrated a certain amount of energy in a region in the scattering of longitudinal vector bosons, produce a classical configuration with a radius which is bigger than the corresponding contour length entering into the game. If this happens, we have a chance to say that we have classicalization of that. Now, the key feature, and then I am going to finish the say, the key feature of about the Nambu-Goldstone bosons that I say, or equivalently the longitudinal polarization of massive vector bosons, is that they naturally define an energy source, which is essentially the reason of the problem, the origin of the root of the problem, that the longitudinal polarization goes like P divided by that. Okay. The rules of the classicalization gain are now the following. For this particular example, solve the equation of motion for the energy source of order square root of S divided by M star. This is something that you can do here because whenever you have this energy localized, the Goldstone bosons, because of the derivative coupling, are source of the corresponding field, are self-sourcing the field, with a strength given by the energy of the process you are considering. Now, the corresponding, look for the corresponding solution, okay, this equation of motion. The corresponding configuration is inevitably created in any scattering process with center of mass energy square root of S. Why? Because whenever we put this energy, and we need energy in order to make a scattering process, since the energy, because of the derivative coupling, is a source of the field, self-source of the field is necessarily created, inevitably created. This is a different from this kind of netter energy sources of two charged electric sources or something like that would be completely independent of the localization energy. In other words, what is crucial for this argument is that the classicalization radius, the size of the classical configuration created by this concentration of energy, will depend on the energy, or in other words, will depend on the localization in which we are putting this energy. Now, the third ingredient is compute the corresponding size, okay, by computing in the classical solution where we reach a moment in which the classical effects of this field, which is the field of our theory, are order one in units of M star of the unitarity scheme. And the system classicalized if it's passing the following test, that this radius is bigger than 1 over M star whenever the energy goes beyond M star, which was the unitarization scale. Now, in this particular case, the elastic scattering amplitude will go like we described the case of the unitarization by black holes, very much exponentially suppressed. But the inclusive cross-section will be essentially geometrical with r star s to the power 2. Now, we have described this thing in the case of the Nambu-Goldstone-Lagrangian, and this morning Gia put in the net a paper with one student that is doing the PhD on that, of Froneng Wayu, in which he did the computation more precisely for this particular example, but coincides completely with the computation that we put in the original paper. Now, we are doing this thing just for fun, okay, not necessarily, but certainly we are doing this thing for fun, but okay. What are the consequences, and with that transparency I finish, for physics in the accelerator, in the LHC? Can we have some prediction? Suppose that we are right. Suppose that the spontaneous symmetry breaking sector of the standard model in the Hissless limit satisfies this condition of classicalization that I am presenting. What are the predictions? Are the predictions neat? Are the predictions clear? Can be this prediction confused with normal Higgs? Can be this prediction confused with Technicolor? Now, the prediction, just very quickly, are essentially the following. What we expect is that we're in the scattering of W's longitudinal W's, what we are going to get whenever we reach the unitarization scale, the TV, if you want, we will start seeing a sort of resonances of mass of the order 1 of L star. In this region here, in this region here, and this will make a lot of discussion, will be very important extra terms in the Lagrangian, but whenever we go into high energies, we get resonances of higher and higher size, and the theory will unitarize at very high energies, just in the inclusive cross-section will be just a geometric cross-section like R star S to the power 2. In summary, the difference with respect to Technicolor is that in Technicolor we will have resonances here, but the inclusive cross-section will diminish with energy. Here we will have increasing with energy. Of course, if this is not the case, rule out this stupid idea. But at least you have a difference of a prediction different from Technicolor. And you will have here a moment in which at some point you will not distinguish these particular resonances from a Higgs. In order to do a precision experiment and to resolve this resonance from the normal Higgs, you need, and this is a laborious work, you need to consider the higher order operators that appears in the Nambu-Goldstone-Lagrangian. But I am not going to enter into that discussion. Then it looks, and this I finish because I am running out of time, it looks in summary that the root of the unitarity problem for amplitudes involving longitudinal polarization can be transformed in a certain sense by means of the equivalence theorem into a virtue, because this means that these objects are energy sources of the field and they satisfy the first condition of this program of classicalization that I want to show. Namely, classicalization of the effective theory or the corresponding Nambu-Goldstone bosons can be the virtue that appears because the problem of unitarity, because the longitudinal polarizations depends on energy. Okay, I have no more time, and then I probably will finish here, and then we can discuss whatever you wish. Thank you very much. Sorry for taking 5 more minutes. Oh, my God. Good.
You keep the BEV, fixed, and takes the mass to infinity. Why doesn't that doesn't that conflict with like a weak, precision like a weak upper bounds on the Higgs mass? Aren't there bounds of like 200 GeV in the Higgs mass and like a weak precision constraints?
Probably I don't. There is a bounce on the higher bounce on the mass of the Higgs.
Like you see these plots that show the.
But this bounce, probably, I assume, I am not familiar with that, but probably this, okay, these bounds are obtained assuming unitarization by Higgs, okay? You see, you have a theory, the defective theory, for example. People is, what is the in other words, in order to get that, you need to unitarize the theory.
But they're not bounds coming from the fact that WW scattering is not.
Okay, I'm not familiar with that bound, but how would you produce this bound, more or less?
It's the fits of all the precision electroweak data. So I think the leading things come from G minus 2 of the muon and from, well, I mean, what, who's
fluke the... Fluke corrections due to the top quark.
Probably, okay, the reason is that you don't have the coupling theorem. Now, this is the problem of this type of theory. You don't have the coupling theorem, you are right. And since you don't have the coupling theorem, the pull the mass of the Higgs is not that you get a theory where the effects of the Higgs are irrelevant, okay? But what I am saying, one thing, okay, suppose, let me just be precise on that. The peculiarity of the Higgs, and this is the reason the Higgs is a complicated business, is essentially what you are saying. I cannot say, oh, let me just put the Higgs to infinity, the mass of the Higgs to infinity. I use the coupling theorem, and it's like not having the Higgs. This theory I'm presenting there is not a fake decoupling theorem, because this would be wrong. The decoupling theory in the case of spontaneous symmetry breaking is not working, as we know. And that's the reason, even if we can get constraints on the mass of the Higgs, or on lambda, if you want, which is the coupling of the Higgs. Now, this is something that you do in the theory where you have Higgs as the procedure to unitarize. Okay? Now, suppose that I give you another procedure to unitarize. I'm not so crazy that my procedure to unitarize is forget the Higgs. Is I need some mechanism in order to unitarize my theory. In this mechanism to unitarize my theory, I can try to check, okay, whatever is your precision, the precision experiment that you are giving me, okay? But of course, it will be totally crazy if I say, because this will mean that the rest of the community is totally stupid, we say, okay, let me just push the Higgs to the infinity, and this is the theory without the Higgs. Okay, of course, no. This theory is sick. This theory is sick. And the reason is that the coupling theorem is not working. Then I need to have effects of the Higgs. This means that I need to unitarize the theory somehow. Otherwise, if you unitarize the theory with the Higgs, you get some constraint on this lambda or this mass. If I unitarize using another stuff, then I will get constraints on what is, for instance, the operators in my Nambu-Goldstone-Lagrangian that are relevant. You see what I mean? And then I will enter into this precision problem. My Lagrangian is certainly not normalizable. Yeah, but this, okay, this is a very... No, this is a very good... Yeah. But let me just make a small comment with respect to this thing. And it's the relation, which is intuitively very clear, between lack of unitarity at three level and renormalizability of the theory. Whenever you have a theory that at three level is not satisfying unitarity bound, you say, okay, I'm going to have problems, because if I go to higher loops, then by dispersion relation, I will have that grows bigger, and then I need to subtract in the dispersion relation with some two contraterms. I go to the next four contraterms. This means that whenever you start at three level with something that is not satisfying unitarity, you run into troubles and you need all these contraterms. Now, in our approach, we say, okay. This will be also the problem in gravity, exactly the same problem in gravity. Suppose that in gravity, and this is unique extra, suppose that in gravity you say, no. The three level is not violating unitarity as you pretend, because I have my black hole that is doing the nice job for me, and then I have that this is not violating unitarity anymore. Then the gain changes, okay? You don't need to start producing all these extra contraterms, okay? The role of this extra higher order derivative terms in the Nambu-Goldstone-Lagrangian, to be totally honest, is something that we are thinking about that will be entering into precision experiments, but I cannot give you a sharp answer about that. Okay.
Tell me. Normally people think that the overlap between a very finer state particles and a very large coherent blob of many quanta essentially rest is exponentially suppressed.
Right.
No,
I use that enormously. precisely I use that. This is part of the game. I create a classical object, okay? And whenever the classical... Not necessarily. This is the way to think in terms of, for instance, tunneling, or for instance, the probability of creating a black hole, if you have energies, and you localize an energy. Suppose that you localize in a certain region an energy that produces an S-Barzil radius bigger than this energy. And I ask you, what is the probability that you generate a black hole in these particular conditions? You will not say that it's exponentially suppressed. Sorry? No, can be extremely large. Let me just go to energies which are ultra-Planckian. You want a black hole of the size of the solar system, I can give you the corresponding energy for that. Suppose that you have these two particles with a huge amount of energy, okay, that you want to localize in a certain region. In a certain moment in the scattering process, you are going to localize this energy in, let's say, this region. Suppose that I have an energy such that this region is the corresponding S-Barzil radius for this energy. If the energy is large enough, okay, this can be very, very large. Okay? Already at this level, the two-particle state in the asymptotic two-particle state becomes this object, whatever it is, which is the black hole. You see what I mean? Okay, in non-gravitational theories, very good question, in non-gravitational theories, we exactly do the same kind of classical computation that you will do for doing that. In gravity, you can discover these kind of things just considering the field created by a source and looking for the moment, for the size at which this field is strong, right? This is the way. The gravitational radius is nothing mysterious. You have the Newton formula, and then you say, okay, when is this order one? Okay, precisely when R is multiplied by L Planck squared, which is the gravitational radius. This means that you are in strong coupling, okay? Now, in order to do that, you need to know what is the solution to the equation of motion for this particular source, in the case of gravity. Then what we do is I take this theory, I put an student to work all the equation of motion perturbatively and so on and so forth, and then I ask him, at what point you start feeling this strong coupling effect? And then there is two type of theories. The theories that renormalize, independently of if they are asymptotically free or not, what happens is that whenever you have more and more energy, you can reach a smaller and smaller, the scattering starts at the smaller regions, which is something very intuitive. If you are very, very fast, you can enter much more than if you are very slow. In the case of the theories that classicalize, what happens is the opposite, okay? And then we compute this kind of RS for these theories. You have a paper you are interested in today, but with some computation more explicit than the ones that we have in our paper. But it's a classical analysis from the Lagrangian, the same kind of analysis that you will do for this gravitational field. Okay. I am not German, okay?
Okay, so you seem to be saying that in these two regimes, the very high energies and low energies, you have this classical description. But exactly transition from the high energy to the low energy regime. Do you have predictions? Is theory predictive in that theory over that transition?
This is a very good question. This is exactly like in the case of quantum gravity. When you are very, very high in the ultraviolet, you can say, oh, I have very large black holes, and so on and so forth. When you are in the infrared, you say, oh, normal physics, and so on and so forth. But you say, oh, let me just put it yourself just on L Planck, okay? What happened there? Now, in L Planck, I believe that you have quanta. In the case of gravity, this is some kind of hallucination that we have also, but this is a different type of discussion. That you have quanta, which are quanta, real quanta. Because this is the moment in which classical size and quantum length identify. Then it's like the transition between the classical into the quantum. Of course, you cannot go from classical to quantum just suddenly. You need some sort of resonance in the middle or some sort of quantum state in the middle. This quantum state would be of the order of the Max Planck in the case of gravity, or this would be quanta of the order of this resonance that I was telling you at the beginning, that is the one that we will expect people discovering the LHC. Now, the role of this quanta, okay, I don't want to enter it. If you don't want to more, I don't want to enter into more discussion. We can do it, yes, in private.
Yeah, your short answer is the theory predictive or not? You
said predict in these quantum states of precisely this particular mass. Because this is the mass where the crossover, let's say, between classical and quantum takes place. Okay? Of course, this happens in any duality. In any duality, normally people understand one side of the duality very far with the other side of the duality. When you go to the self-dual, let's say, point, okay, then the situation, then you need to add this extra quantum degrees of freedom.
In the black hole, the probability to create some specific two particles at the end after it evaporates is exponentially small.
Right.
Very fast normalized.
Right. It's the Boltzmann factor, essentially.
But we haven't showed the same thing for the...
No, I didn't show the same thing. I used the standard intuition that we have in physics, that is any classical configuration. Okay, the decay, if it's a classical configuration, the decay time of a classical configuration must be bigger than the size of the classical configuration. Otherwise, it's not a classical configuration. And this is intuitive, okay? You get any object that is a coherent state, okay, then the decay in precisely one particular state must be suppressed because of the huge number of degrees of freedom you have in your theory. This normally people understand in terms of thermalization in the case of the black hole, but I don't see why you need thermalization. Yeah, the black hole is a very good scrambler for information and so on and so forth, but in order to say something like as simple, like a classical configuration decay in a particular quantum state, the probability of decay in a particular quantum state is exponentially suppressed. Probably I'm wrong, but I don't need such a huge battery of information about thermalization in the horizon or anything like that, right? The probability to get back the same state equal 1. This would be just if this is not a classical object, okay? Essentially here I'm using, if you want, I am using that this classical object contains a huge amount of degrees of freedom. That's the reason the inclusive cross-section, otherwise the inclusive cross-section is bigger, okay? I am not proving using thermalization. I am not proving using thermalization. This is, you are right on that. But my claim is that I don't need it.
Okay. Okay. Of course, I will. If you insist, I will prove it for you. But think in any simple example in which you have a classical configuration. You have many classical configurations in physics, and of course, the probability that you can create in many ways. And the probability to decay in because it's a coherent state. I give you the point that I am not using this thermalization. I am using entropy if you want, because I have a huge amount of degrees of freedom. A gas has entropy and it's not a black hole, okay? Because I have many molecules there. And then the probability to get particular state, which is suppressed.
You're saying the probability of a particular two-particle final state is exponentially small.
Right.
This is already in a thermal state.
You are thinking because you are thinking that this suppression is a Boltzmann factor. You are thinking in terms of thermality, but not necessarily.
It's not thermal at all.
No. I
mean, the whole thing is unitary and.
Okay, we can discuss it.
Okay, well, maybe we should. So, Cesar is here all week. Let's thank him again.
Okay.